Can you put that slide back up for just a second, Adam? The Derbyshires, there was a big thing a while back about, you know, the you're only like, what is it, five, six, seven points of connection from somebody who knows. Well, interestingly, this same thing was shared at the Dolan Church this morning, you know, at the Dolan Springs Church. And it turns out that one of the members there has a personal relationship with the Derbyshires and has met them and gave testimony about their work and how effective it is and their family and the things that they're doing for God. And so you know somebody who knows somebody, okay, who knows somebody, okay? However that works, okay? I just thought it was interesting. Nothing spiritual about it, but just interesting. If you have your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 16. Thanks, Adam. Matthew chapter 16. Now, we were in Matthew chapter 16 last week. For those of you who are attentive and can remember that and realize, didn't you preach that last week? Well, yes, but I preached something just a little different too, okay? But we're going to be in Matthew chapter 16 today. And last week, we did talk about the passage in it that's there about Peter and his confession. Remember, what we've done is we've been talking about this thing called discipleship. I haven't ever formally introduced this to you, but we talked about the call that Peter and Andrew and James and John received. They were fishermen in the boats, and Jesus came along and called them, and he said, come, follow me, and I'll make you fishers of men. We talked about what that meant, okay, in their lives, and we talked about the calling, the come, that Jesus is always extending an invitation. He's always seeking out and inviting us to follow him deeper. Follow us more completely. Follow us more faithfully. And that's the thing. It's come and follow me. And he says, I'll make you a fisher of men. And then later, whenever last week we looked at Peter as he was out, or a couple weeks back, we looked at Peter as he was in the other disciples. They were in the boat. They were crossing the lake, and the storm came up. And we talked about how even there, as Jesus walked across the water and Peter responded, Jesus' invitation was still there. Come, come. He invited Peter to come and join him. And through the storms of life, keep that in mind, through the storms of life, God is still calling us. He uses those storms to call us into a deeper relationship with him. And we talked about that aspect before. And remember, at the end of that, we talked about how the first time Jesus stilled the water, which was earlier in Matthew, in the Gospel of Matthew, that Jesus had been asleep in the bottom of the boat, and they came and woke him up and said, you know, the storm's going to overtake us. We're going to perish. And he says, oh, you foolish people. And he calmed the storm. And they were marveled at who he was. And they said, who is this guy? That, you know, they were amazed that he could calm a storm. But then this time when Peter had stepped out of the boat, and then Jesus and Peter stepped back in the boat, and the storm was calmed. What did they call him? They called him the Son of God. And last week, then, we looked deeper, and now they were no longer looking at Jesus as the Son of God. But when Jesus asked him, who do people say that I am? And they gave a list of all these people. We looked at all the different prophets and people that he was mentioning and their implications and what it meant. And we looked at the fact that Jesus then turned it back, and he says, but who do you say I am? And the point is that every one of us is going to have to deal with that very question. Every person is at one day going to have to stand before Christ and say who they think he is, who he is. And we need to deal with that now. We're either going to face it here on this side of the grave, or we're going to pass through the portal of death and we're going to face it there. And personally, I want to be ready to say, you are the Son of the living God. And that's what they responded. He was no longer just the Son of God. He was the Son of the living God. And we talked about how that living was important because it was in contrast to all the idols that they had seen in the area around them. And the temples where these stone statues were standing that were lifeless and had no power and had no breath of life in them. And Peter proclaimed he was the Son of the living God, the God who gives life and breathes life into every one of us, who sustains us with his life-giving power, and who has created all that we know. You are the Son of the living God. You're the anointed one, he said. You're the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one, the one who has been ordained by God to come and bring deliverance to his people. So today we're going to go on and just think about how Peter felt. You know, remember how Jesus responded there? He says, wow, he says, this has been revealed to you by God. You didn't get this on your own. And he talked about the confession, says a confession upon that. We're going to build the church. But he says all those things. And here, now, Peter is now kind of feeling like he's the top student in the class. He's number one. He's got the pat on the back, and he feels good. He feels good. So here's what goes on from that point, because now it's interesting what has just happened. He just told them, he just got them to acknowledge that he was the Christ, the Son of the living God. Their eyes, and this is two and a half, you know, years into his three and a half year ministry, okay? We don't know exactly when it occurred, but it's toward the end. And Jesus, after all this time of being with him, they finally came to realize that he was the Son of the living God. And it says in verse 21, it says, then from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hand of the elders, the chief priest, and the teachers of the law. Now think about that for a second. He finally got them to realize that he was the Messiah, the anointed one. And then he says, well, I am, but you got the whole thing wrong. See, they thought that the Messiah was going to be the king, the king that came in, the earthly king, that he would set up a king, he'd recruit an army, they'd fight against the Romans that occupied Israel, and they'd conquer them and cast them out, and they'd take over, and they'd conquer the world. And David's descendant, the promise of, and fulfillment of David's descendant, would be set upon the throne, and they would rule forever. Israel would be the king, or the nation in charge of the entire world. That's what they were thinking, okay? That's the image they had. And Jesus began telling them, he says, boy, you got it wrong, guys. He says, look, he says, I must suffer. I am the anointed one, but I'm going to have to suffer. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and they're going to hand me over to the elders, the chief priests, these guys. They're going to beat on me. They're going to torment me. And eventually he goes on and he says, and that he must be killed. I'm going to be killed. I'm going to die. Now, I don't know about you, you know, we're in the midst of this thing with my wife and her cancer things, and the first time we went through this, I'm not saying, I don't encourage anyone to try and go through it a couple of times, but that's terrible. But the first time we went through this, we went into the doctor to sit down and discuss what the lymphoma was, and some 20 years ago or so. And we sat down and we were there, and the doctor comes and he starts explaining to us what this cancer is and what the implications are. And he says something to us, and I can't remember exactly what it was at this time, but both of us just shut down. He talked for another 45 minutes or so, and we have no idea what he said, okay? Because we were stuck right there on what he said. And we couldn't hear the rest of it. And I'm sure you guys have had experiences where you've gotten bad news. You've gotten something that just kind of devastates you, and you sit there and you're numb and you can't take anything else. Your brain just stops. And that's kind of what it was. And I think that's what happened to Peter. He got to that point, he says, you're going to suffer, you're going to die? And he just stopped. He didn't hear the next part that Jesus said, which was what? He says, I lost my spot. And he says, And teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. So Jesus is telling him, that's not the end of the story. But Peter stopped listening. How often do we do the same thing? He stopped listening, didn't get the rest of the story and know that there was going to be a good ending to it, that Christ was going to be raised to the dead. And so Peter's stuck there, and he's thinking about these terrible things. And he's thinking, it's, you know, now don't forget, Peter's kind of puffed up a little bit. He's thinking, hey, I'm a number one student. I got the answer right. Nobody else got it. I got it. Oh, I know what to do here. And so he steps up and he takes Jesus aside. And in verse 22, it says, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Now, that, understand, That word rebuke is kind of strong, and I think that's a reason why they use it. The implication is not necessarily that it was harsh. Okay, understand, Peter's rebuke wasn't harsh like we sometimes think of a rebuke. It was more like taking him aside, taking him by the hand and saying, come over here, I got to talk to you, okay? And he's thinking, I got to instruct him now not to talk about these. I got to instruct him as to what. Now think about it. Here's Peter, okay? Jesus is the master, right? Jesus is the leader. Jesus is the Son of God. And Peter just confessed that, but he says, you don't understand. You don't understand, Jesus. You can't talk about those things. You let me tell you what it's going to be like. Think about that for a second. Let it sink in, because I think it's hilarious, to tell you the truth. How often times, here's God. Guys, just think for a second. Here's God. He has created all of the heavens and the earth. He's created everything that exists. He understands things about life and living that I could not. He wrote the DNA code that it has taken scientists hundreds and hundreds of years to decipher, and they still can't spell anything correctly. They just kind of understand finding that it's an alphabet, and it took us thousands of years to get. We've got put the greatest minds in the world together, and we cannot even create life. Now, they'll tell you that they've created, well, what they've created is the building blocks, the amino acids. But they can't even get that right. They can't get the left ones and the right ones created all together at the same time. So the consequence is that we still don't know how to create life. Yet God did. God created this. I have problems keeping 5 telephone numbers in my brain, okay? And remembering, and here's God with all these things, And if I were Peter, I'd be going to him and saying, well, here, God, let me tell you how to do it. Yeah, yeah. Isn't that hilarious? And that was Peter. He was coming up. Now, the reason why Peter is so appealing to us is because he's just like us. We do the same thing. We're always taking God and saying, God, look, you need to do this the way I think you should do it. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's in our family relationships. It doesn't matter whether it's in our jobs. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's in our life choices. Because, see, if I were God, I would have said, Curtis, you're going to be a billionaire. You're going to design all these wonderful things, okay? What does he do? He sticks me and says, you're going to preach instead. Now, that's not the design, the plan I would have, okay? But God takes our dreams and stuff, and he says, look, let me shape them. Let me fulfill my life. My desires through you, okay? Because this way you're going to know the true happiness. You're going to know the true meanings of life that you're searching for. And we're trying always to shape God. We're trying to put him in the box that we've designed for him. And we're saying, God, this is who you are, and you can't be anything other than what we can fit into this box. Yet I can't comprehend in my mind the things that he knows. Okay, I cannot comprehend even my finite mind cannot hold his infinity. Think about that. And so Peter takes Jesus aside and says, here, God, Jesus, let me explain to you. And what does he say? What does he say to him? He says, to rebuke him, he says, never, Lord, he said, this shall never happen to you. I want you to understand, if you have a different translation, There are a whole bunch of ways of translations in how this passage is translated. And I think that part of it is because it's kind of vague and not quite sure how to interpret the Greek. But in my interlinear, my Greek-English interlinear, which I use frequently, okay, guys, just so you know where I get this. But in the Greek interlinear, it translates this. The Greek word there is helos. And it can be translated maybe gracious, okay? Instead of a God forbid, as some translations say, I think it's, I'll get this. It's translated, in the NIV it says, never, Lord. Some translations say, God forbid. Some say, never, never, kind of thing. It's more about this idea of mercy. And he's saying, in the way I take it, is Peter is more saying, oh, you know, God be merciful, may it never happen, kind of thing. It's more like a plea that this can't be what's really going to happen, rather than a rebuke or a, you know, a chastisement in that sense. It's more Peter showing his concern. And he said, this shall never happen to you. Again, here's the Son of God, and Peter just confessed that he was the Son of God, and then he turns around and ignores that fact. Jesus, who is the Son of God, knows the plan that God has for him. He's accepted that, and he's received it, and he says, yes, God, I want to submit myself to your will. I want to do what you've called me to do. And then Peter comes up and says, no, no, you can't let that happen. Mercy, no. No, he says. And Jesus, in verse 23, it says, Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Satan. Wow. What a strong rebuke. Okay, well, you can think about that for a second. And if you look at Matthew chapter 4, you can kind of understand it. But that word Satan that we translate, it's more of a transliteration from the Arabic and the Hebrew, okay? Aramaic and the Hebrew. It's a translation of that word, transliteration, literally, and that's, we're just taking the sounds that they have and making it, Englishize it, it comes out Satan. It means, if you translated it, it would mean adversary. So what he's saying to Peter, he says, Peter, no longer are you the confessor who understood that I was the chosen Son of God and I was the anointed Messiah. You have now become my adversary. You're standing against the things of God. You're saying no. Now, you guys may chastise Peter for that, but think about it for just a second. How many times do we run to interfere and rescue somebody from the distress that they've created? Okay, to try and help them out and be merciful to them, just like Peter was trying to say to Jesus, be merciful. And what we're doing is we're interfering with the work of God. We're standing between them. God puts our child in a difficult situation, and what we want to do is we want to go help them out of it. We want to take them away from it and take them out of that suffering that they're in so that they can be spared that. And God says, wait, I'm doing a work in that. I need that suffering in that child's life in order to shape them. And we want to rescue people. And it's not just our children. It's other people, too, constantly. Instead of letting them go through and suffer the consequences of their life choices and other things, we're always trying to rescue and to keep them from experiencing. God has plans for each of our lives, okay? Jesus understood what that plan was. He knew that he had to go through the suffering of the cross. He knew that he needed to yield his life to God, submit himself, and die on that cross in order to bring about your redemption and my redemption. He knew that. And he saw, and here was Peter saying, no, you can't do that. And Jesus knew right then he was the adversary. Now, if you look in Matthew chapter 4, you're going to find the same story where Satan came and said to him, Jesus, he says, he's tempting him. Jesus had fasted 40 days, and he comes and he says, look, here's an easier way. And he does it repeatedly, and finally he says, look, takes him up and shows him the kingdoms of the world. And don't forget, in a sense, Christ was coming back to redeem those kingdoms. Christ was coming back to take the possessions of the world and bring it back and submit it to the Father, okay? Because Satan had stolen them from man. And here was Jesus, and Satan was saying, look, I'll give you everything that you want. I'll give you the things that you want. Just bow down and worship me, is what he says. And the point was, is Jesus knew that was not the will of the Father. And he said, get behind me, Satan. And he just said it to Peter. And he resisted. And he stood against Satan and caused him to leave. Okay? And Satan left. In the same way, he had to stand against Peter because Peter was trying to show him another way. Yes, it would still accomplish the same things that God wanted, but it wasn't the way that God wanted it done. And he goes on and he says, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. Now listen to this. This is the phrase to underline in your Bible if you're going to underline anything. He says, you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. See, that's the focus, folks. The point is Peter looked at the suffering of Christ from man's point of view and says, can't do that. And Jesus was saying, you need to look at it from God's point of view. You need to see what's being accomplished from God's perspective. And so oftentimes we want to go through life evaluating things from our eye, through our eyes as human beings, and not seeing what God is doing in the life of the people around us. And we need to ask God to open our eyes that we can understand what he's doing. We need to have God bring and impart to us the wisdom we need to understand. Now, here's the point. Jesus goes on, and it's important here. He says, then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. Now, he's told them something very pointedly there. He says, if you're going to follow me, you're going to suffer. You know, folks, they didn't wear crosses around their neck. It wasn't a piece of jewelry. They had crosses to suffer on, to die upon. And Jesus is saying, you're going to have to deny what you want, deny yourself, and you're going to have to go through the suffering of the cross. Now, think about it for a second. Now, let me back up just a second. Jesus was saying, God is at work. He's going to, through this suffering, he's going to bring out about a mighty thing. How many of you guys would be absolutely ecstatic if I took a piece of coal, ugly, dark, dirty coal, and handed it to you and say, here, it's a present? How many of you guys would just say, wow, thanks, Curtis? No, you wouldn't, would you? Because it's ugly, it's dirty, it's nasty. You wouldn't have any use for it. But how about if I took that piece of coal and put it under the pressure of the earth for hundreds of years and allowed the pressure of the earth to force itself upon it, to shape that piece of coal and to press upon it and to cause suffering within that piece of coal, and then dug it out and handed it to you and said, here, take this diamond that has gone through the suffering. It's the same piece of coal. It's just gone through the pressure and the suffering of life. You see, that's what God is doing in each of our lives. He's taking us and putting us through the suffering and the pressures of life to shape us and to make us like Christ. And another example is the butterfly. You guys, butterflies are great. You see them flopping around and they got the neat wings, right? And this little boy, this story is told about a little boy who saw a caterpillar and it made a cocoon. And he watched that caterpillar weave that cocoon, and he watched it. And every day he'd come back and he'd watch that cocoon and look to see what was happening with it. And finally, one day the cocoon had opened up and the butterfly was striving to come out of that cocoon. And it was struggling. It was making every effort. And quickly the boy ran inside the house, got a pair of scissors, and snipped open that cocoon so the butterfly could get out. He didn't want it to struggle and have to work so hard. And as that butterfly continued to crawl out of that cocoon, no longer constrained by the cocoon, it came out and its wings were crippled. And the reason was because he didn't suffer coming out of the cocoon. You see, the force of the struggling coming out of that cocoon would force the blood into the wings and then cause them to expand and to open up and provide the wings that that butterfly needed. But because it was deprived of the suffering, of the struggle, it could not fly. It was crippled. And see, that's what happens when we go and we rescue those who are struggling in this life. We can't change some of that stuff. And we need to learn to see from God's perspective what's going on so that we no longer stand as an adversary to what God is doing, but we have the mind of God and have the concerns of heaven in our heart so that we help those who are around us to grow. And Jesus says you have to deny themselves. He says you have to deny yourself. And folks, I commend, you know, the Catholics, and I don't know, there may be others who practice that art of Lent every season, every year it comes around, and they take Lent and they say, okay, well, I'm going to swear off chocolate. I'm going to deny myself. I'm not going to have a piece of chocolate every day for a month, okay? And they think that that's the suffering. That, you guys, I want to tell you, denying yourself is not, and what Jesus is talking about, not denying yourself chocolate. It's not that. Okay, it's something greater. It's the fact that what you're trying to do is say, I am going to deny my own values. I'm going to deny what I think is right, and I'm going to put those aside. I'm going to deny my way of thinking, and I'm going to come over here, and I'm going to embrace heaven's concerns. I'm going to embrace the things of God and allow Him to speak to my heart. You know, we have all sorts of ideas. We have political, financial, we have social ideas, social values that we place, and we say, these are the things I believe, these are the things, and we've never yet taken them to the throne of God and laid them there and denied ourselves and said, God, you give me your beliefs. You give me what you believe to be right, and allow that to take place in my heart. Replace my concerns, my human concerns, and give me the concerns of heaven. And we see it all around us that we need to do this. And Peter went on, Jesus went on in verse 26, he says, what good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? And Jesus is just simply challenging them. He says, listen, you need to weigh. You need to weigh your temporal satisfaction with the eternity. Is what you gain here in this world going to be what you have to forfeit in eternity? Your soul is worth everything. And if you forfeit your soul here in order to gain temporary satisfaction, he says you're going to have nothing in eternity. But if you forfeit what's in this world and you do away with that, you take your concerns, your human concerns, put those aside, and you embrace God's concerns, the concerns of heaven, he says, then in there you will gain your soul in eternity. Now, Peter listened to this, and we can look at that and say, wow, that was a strong rebuke upon Peter. And we can step back and just think, wonder how he felt and things like that. But I want to tell you something. I think Peter learned right then and there. Well, I don't know if it was right then and there, but I think after the crucifixion and he saw what unfolded, he learned about this suffering. If you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. And listen to what Peter later wrote. Now, this is years later. And Peter finally kind of got this concept of that suffering. And in the first part, in verse 18, it's talking about the position as the slaves. And I think that's kind of, it's immaterial as it relates to today. But, there's still meaning there, but in verse 19, he says, for it is commendable. This is 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 19. He says, for it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. So he's coming now, instead of saying, oh, you're never going to suffer, he says, look, suffering is sometimes good, is what he says. And in verse 20, he says, but how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, that is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Did you catch all that? He says, look, if you go out and you do something stupid and you suffer because of it, you get drunk and you run into a tree and you have consequences because of that, you do something stupid and you suffer because of it, he says, that's nothing. He says, but listen, if you're busy pursuing the things of God and you end up suffering because of your pursuit of God, he says, that's commendable, because God is going to use that. Just like he used that pressure to shape a diamond, just like he used the struggle of the butterfly to grow its wings and to make it so it could fly, that kind of suffering is commendable before God. He will set you free in that. He will help you become all that he wants you to be. So which is more important, your human concerns or the concerns of God? That's the question. How will you choose to live today? Isn't Peter wonderful? He so oftentimes reveals my own heart. I don't know about yours. I can't speak for you. But I think that's why people love him, because we see ourselves in him so much. He holds up a mirror to us, because we would do the same. I would do the same thing. No, Jesus, you can't suffer. I wouldn't want him to. Without realizing that the concerns of heaven are greater than anything I could want in my own heart. And then God's going to take my dreams, when I yield them to him, when I submit them to him, he's going to take my dreams, my ambitions, and he's going to change them into what's good. I offer to him a lump of coal, and he gives back to me a diamond. That's the God I serve. Let's pray. Father, I just thank you for that you've been here with us today. I thank you for your goodness to us. And Father, I don't understand some of these encounters that take place, but I know that you use these things to teach us, to grow us, to shape us, and to make us. And Father, I don't understand necessarily the suffering in my life and the life of others that I encounter. I don't have explanations. But I know that you're a loving God. You are the God of all creation. And I know who you are in that sense. And I pray, God, that as I continue to live in this world, you will continue to reveal yourself to me and to those in this congregation, that we'll understand you better. I don't know that we can ever understand all of you, all of who you are. But I know, God, that you can help us to know you better, and that's our desire. Help us to take this message and learn from